Thank you. My name is Pat Yeo, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much for inviting me to share at this meeting. I have been asked to talk about steps 8 and 9, so that's what I'm going to do because I learned how to follow direction here. I will just say briefly that I started drinking when I was 13. I was at a party that night, and people were drinking, so I drank. And I woke up the next morning in bed with a Marine that I didn't know. It was a lot more than I meant to do that night. You know, the girls in my crowd weren't behaving this way. And I was embarrassed and ashamed and terrified I'd get pregnant and, you know, had a lot of bad feelings that next day. But I drank again at the very next possible opportunity. I believe I was an alcoholic from the gate. I think I crossed that invisible line that night. It doesn't really matter, but that's what I believe. My drinking that night sort of set the tone for what my drinking was going to look like. When I drink, as I like to describe it, I get real friendly. And so I developed a reputation in high school for being the friendly girl. And that's not the reputation anybody wants. You know, I knew people were talking about me and it made me feel bad, but I don't remember ever thinking about maybe not drinking so I wouldn't behave that way. You know, it just never really crossed my mind. By the time I was 21 or 22, I was married to my second husband. It was a terrible marriage. I met him. I was working as a go-go dancer in a really bad, cheap dive bar. And, he was a customer there. So obviously we were meant to be together when I think about it like that. I was not a faithful wife, because I'm an alcoholic. And as I said, when I drink, I get friendly. And so although I'm married again, I'm still sleeping with anybody and everybody. And so, you know, that describes my life drinking pretty much in, you know, a half a paragraph. So by the time I got sober when I was 30 years old, and by the time I got sober, my life was in such a mess that I could not imagine it ever changing. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I could not stop drinking. I had tried to stop drinking on my own for quite a while, and I couldn't do it. I'd be filled with, you know, the older I got, the less I bounced back in the morning, let's just say. You know, the hangovers were horrific, and my life was just in the toilet. I wasn't getting along with this husband. My parents and I weren't getting along. I was working a little teeny tiny job where I'd been, had really good jobs, you know, earlier in my 20s, and there was nothing in my life that was working. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and, got a sponsor and had no idea what was about to happen to my life. You know, I started taking these steps and I wrote that inventory, and I might as well talk about this first, that, you know, I had, like I think a lot of people, I had the big secret, you know, the one I was going to take to my grave. And I knew when my sponsor, when I got to the fourth step, I knew that, that needed to be in there, but I also knew I couldn't possibly do it. I could not possibly imagine myself telling anybody out loud about these things that I had done. But I wanted to stay sober. And so I figured, okay, the big secret, by the way, was my stepfather. There were things going on in my house when I was growing up that shouldn't have been going on. I hated him. I had very good reason to hate him. Anybody would agree I had good reason to hate him, and I did. I didn't really see it as a problem for today, so to speak, because I don't live there anymore. These things are not happening to me anymore. So, you know, I kind of thought out of sight, out of mind, except the longer I stayed sober, the more I thought about it. And also the longer it seemed to me that every meeting I went to, the speaker would sort of lean into the microphone, stare directly at me, and say something like, resentments kill alcoholics, especially justifiable resentments. And I'd think, ooh, man, I got one of those for sure, you know. So I finally decided I would write about it in my inventory. I would never actually do a fifth step, or I might do a fifth step, but just leave that part out. Long story short, you know, I read the whole thing to my sponsor. It took me longer to read this one little paragraph about my stepfather than it did pages that came after that, because I cried and carried on and, you know, but I got it out. And I thought that would be like, whew, that's the end of that. Don't have to think about that anymore. But of course I did, because I did have a giant resentment. So the day came, and I just have to say, I did not leap into this. I was about 5 years sober before I got around to this. My first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober, and I got a new sponsor. And somehow this business about my stepfather got sort of pushed to the background. I'm not sure that I actually had even mentioned it to this new sponsor yet. And so, but now I'm 5 years sober and I'm thinking about it all the time. And I talked to my sponsor finally about it. And she said, well, it's very clear you need to make amends to your stepfather. And I'm like, what? Let me rephrase. Perhaps you weren't listening when I told you what happened here. I was a kid, you know, come on. He should be making amends to me. And she said, yeah, he probably should, but he's not an AA and I'm not his sponsor. You are. I want you to stay sober. She said, you've been making living amends to your mother now for 5 years, however long I was sober, for the stuff, you know, that we do to our mothers, the grief, the anguish, the worry that we put them through. She said, your stepfather was living in the house at the same time you were causing your mother all that grief. Perhaps he was a little concerned as well. Why don't you just take that sort of same list of things and use that as your jumping off point? There's a problem with this. I love my mother. I'm sorry I did those things to my mother. I was sorry when I was drunk and doing it. You know, I hate my stepfather. What do I care if he was a little worried? I mean, I don't see the point of this, but I didn't want to drink. I just didn't want to drink. And so I drove out to their house one day. They lived about an hour away at the time. I drove out to their house and he was out in the garden doing some stuff. And I went out there and I had this little conversation with him. And I said something along the lines of, you know, I know that I caused a lot of trouble and worry and anguish and all the stuff I just said when I was a teenager in this house. And I'm sorry for that. I obviously can't change any of that. But I am sorry that I put you through all of that. And I want you to know that I'm going to try to be a better stepdaughter from this moment forward. I left right away after I had this little conversation because I knew if I hung around, we were going to be talking about his shortcomings. And there's a line in the book that says, his faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. And I knew absolutely that if I talked about his faults, I was going to have to do this. It would like negate the whole thing and I'd have to do it all over again. And I did not want to do this twice. I did not want to have this conversation twice. So I said what I had to say and I left and I was driving home. And I remember being in the car thinking, well, okay, these steps don't work on everything because I've made amends to him and I hate him as much as I ever did. Well, I hadn't actually made amends. I'd kind of made the announcement that amends were coming, but the actual amends are what I said at the end. I'm going to try to be a better stepdaughter from this moment forward. That's the actual amends. Amends aren't about clearing my conscience or, you know, it's about making things right. And so that was not a happy realization, by the way, when I recognized that fact, but I started trying to do that. I started in little small ways. When I called my mother, if he answered the phone, instead of saying, hi, it's me, let me talk to mom, which is what I had done up to that point, I would start saying, hi, it's me, how are you? And he'd say something. And then I'd say, let me talk to mom. And then I started, every time you hear me say, I thought, that means my sponsor or somebody told me, just to be clear here. I don't have any really good original thoughts myself. Somebody said, probably my sponsor suggested that a kind and loving daughter might actually chat with him a little bit too about whatever. And so I would think of topics of conversation that I thought I could chat with him about. I think of them as generic topics. You know what I'm saying? Like nothing really to do with me. If I'd seen a movie that week, that was a good topic. I remember the Olympics were in Los Angeles around this period of time. And my husband and I had gone to a number of Olympic events and that was a great topic. I used that one for weeks. And so I'd call, I'd be sweating doing this because I was so nervous about it. I'd call, he'd answer. I'd say, hello, how are you? And he'd respond. And then I'd say, oh, we went to this, you know, we saw the gymnastics thing or whatever last night. It was so cool. And he'd respond. And now I'm drenched in sweat. And then I'd ask to speak to mom. And I just kept doing that. And then Christmas was coming up that year that I started doing this. And somebody said to me, you know, a kind and loving daughter would not just rush out on Christmas Eve and pick up a shirt or a tie and have the store wrap it. A daughter might actually put a little thought into a gift. And so I remember sitting on my couch saying a little prayer. And I said, God, I believe that I should put some thought into a gift for him, but I have no idea what he might like or use. Please help me out with a little inspiration here. And I sat on my couch and I waited for inspiration to strike. Inspiration never strikes on my couch. My experience with prayer is that I need to say the prayer and then there's always action involved for me. it occurred to me finally that perhaps the action here might be to go to a mall where things are, and maybe inspiration could strike a little sooner. So I went down to this mall and walking around trying to think, what would he like? Went into this needlepoint store. At the time I did a lot of needlepoint, and there was a thing on the, a thing to needlepoint and frame and hang on the wall, a saying about fathers and daughters. And I thought, oh no, 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 I don't feel any of that sentiment there. I swear to you, that thing followed me around the store. I finally bought it. I did my nicest work. Ladies who do needlepoint know it takes a fair amount of time to do it. I did it nicely. I gave it to him at Christmas. And there was a moment when he opened that, he got a little tear in the corner of his eye. It was here and gone that fast, but I saw it. And that little moment kept me going a long time. That little moment helped me know that whatever it was I was doing here, if I kept trying to do that, I wasn't going to have to drink over this. It was the following Christmas. My husband and I were in, or before Christmas, we were in Yosemite, and Ansel Adams has a studio there, the photographer. And there was a big photograph of Vernal Falls. When my stepfather married my mother, I was, I think, 8 years old. And the first vacation we took was to Yosemite, and we all hiked up Vernal Falls. And I was eight, and I was kind of puny for my age. And so I got really tired. So he had put me on his shoulders, and he was sort of dancing down the trail. And it is truly one of the happiest memories of my childhood. So I bought this thing, this picture, and I wrapped it up. And on the card, I wrote basically what I just said to you, that this was one of the happiest memories of my childhood. And I gave it to him at Christmas, and he loved it. He hung it up right away in the bedroom there. And maybe a year after that, at least 6 months after that, I was at their house, and I happened to sit in his chair. And on the table by where he always sat was the card where I'd written that sentiment, and it was completely dog-eared. He must have picked that card up hundreds of times and read it. It was such a powerful spiritual moment for me. I absolutely 100% knew that if I kept doing this, God was going to make this resentment bearable enough I would never have to pick up a drink over it. I knew it. You know, time went on. I don't always notice when the resentment goes away. You know, I get so busy in the solution, I don't notice that it's gone. He was a very troubled man, obviously, but I mean, he actually committed suicide. When he was in the hospital for a couple of days before he died, and I went to the hospital, and he was in a coma, and I was sitting by his bed and said a prayer, and there wasn't a moment where I thought, oh, I wish he'd wake up so I could say whatever. Everything had been said. I knew 100% I had made my amends to this man. 100%. He did die, and that resentment has never returned. It's gone. I believe, you know, if I'm willing to say the prayer and then take the action, God takes care of his end, you know, which is to take the resentment away. And my experience is that, you know, I hear people say, and this sounds like I'm criticizing, I start a sentence like that, I'm not, but that they're working on a resentment. I don't see anywhere in the book that it tells me to work on a resentment. It tells me to ask God to remove them. And my sponsor said, ask God to remove them and then act as though he already has. And that's worked very well for me. Anyway, so I get sober, and I'm in this terrible marriage to this guy. And, you know, I've been cheating on him all the years we've been married, and now I'm sober. And, I actually hadn't thought about that in sobriety, I might stop cheating, but none of the men in AA seemed to be interested in me, which kind of hurt my feelings. We fought a lot about AA meetings. He didn't want me coming here. He did think that I was coming here to meet men. So I felt really, really sorry for myself. So I was about 10 months sober, and I met a man in a meeting who looked real good to me. Actually, I'd met a number of men who looked really good to me, but this one looked back. I was 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came in the door the first time. He had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head. Honest to God, my heart started to pound. I could hardly contain myself. I literally leapt across a chair to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed. And so I go over to my sponsor, and she said, Pat, let's not forget that you're a married woman. And I said, yeah, but I'm so unhappy. She said, nonetheless, you're married. And as long as you're married, I expect you to act married. I don't see this as a problem at all. Get divorced. She said, no, we in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. Stay married, act married. Well, I was obsessed with this guy. I mean, why would God get him sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? It seems so clear to me. I don't know why she couldn't see that. His sponsor didn't see it either, I might add. But so we began, you know, it's, if you're sober a while, you know how you've either done it yourself or you've certainly seen it. It starts, we're giving each other these deep, meaningful glances across the AA meeting hall. And then we're kind of brushing up against each other in the coffee line. And then he's walking me to my car after the meeting. And then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting. And it's a little tiny bit complicated to get together because I'm a married woman. Clearly we're not going to my place. He's a newcomer. He doesn't have a place. But we're very resourceful people. We can pretty much make anything happen. I was at the time working at a record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently working in Hollywood as well at a porn bookstore. I arranged a long lunch. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, you just can't. I arranged a long lunch hour at work one day for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either. So I went and picked him up at the bookstore, and we went to a motel, and I'll just say we got to know each other better. I dropped him off at the bookstore that afternoon. I was driving back to my office and sitting in the car, it occurred to me that I was 10 months sober and I was living exactly the way I'd always lived. I've been sitting in meetings for 10 months hearing you say pretty much every night I was going to have to change everything about the way I've been living or I was most certainly going to drink. And I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I will tell you that I've been sober for 45 and a half years, and that day is the closest I've been to drinking. Was that day, because I knew that I needed to find a way to change this, but I don't know. It's how I've always lived. I was also terrified to tell my sponsor because she had been quite clear in her direction about this guy, but I did tell her that night, and she said, you know, Pat, I don't think that you're a woman who can stay, she can cheat on her husband and stay sober, and you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. Okay, I don't want to. I've never wanted to. Drunk or sober, I never wanted to live like that. That is never the woman I meant to be. Wanting has never changed a thing. She said, I want you a day at a time to just stay away from this guy. I thought I should maybe explain to him what was going to happen here. Ran that idea by her, and she said, oh, no, I think he'll get the idea. You do not need to be having any more conversations with him. Just stay away from him. And so I did that a day at a time. I didn't drive by that bookstore. A day at a time, I didn't call him on the phone. A day at a time when he called me, I did not answer the phone. A day at a time when I saw him in meetings, I shook hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, that means we never got closer than the entire length of my arm. Hello. And I kept moving. The obsession, of course, passed. Obsessions always pass. But the really good news for me is that I don't live that way anymore. I didn't know that the way you can change behavior is to, this sounds so silly, but you change your behavior. Who knew? You know, I mean, I just stayed away from that guy and the obsession passed. The really, really good news for me is that I don't live that way anymore. It wasn't just that one guy changing my behavior, asking God to remove this lust and changing my behavior, changed the whole rest of my life. I don't live that way anymore. Now, I know you're thinking, of course you don't. You're 76 years old. So to be clear, I haven't lived that way since then. And I was 31 then. So just to be real clear about all this. No, I was 35 then, I guess. I don't know. 31. Doesn't matter. My first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober. And I got a new sponsor right away. And this woman said to me, you know, I've watched you from afar whine and complain about your husband and how, you know, terrible your marriage is. And she said, it is clear to me that you owe a lot of amends to this guy. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very clear. You can't go confess infidelities that he doesn't know about. That's not making amends. You know, there's a line in the book that says we can't buy our peace of mind at the expense of others. You know, that's not making amends. Making amends is about making things right. She said, I would suggest to you that a way to make amends to him is to start acting as though you're a kind and loving wife. just pretend to be a kind and loving wife. It sounded so stupid to me. I couldn't even believe she was saying it to me. But I had a lot of guilt in this relationship. And she said, you could leave your husband, but if you do, you're just going to repeat your same patterns over and over and over again. Why don't you just try this? And so I did. I remember the first thing she told me was every day when he came home from work, I was to ask him how his day went and look at him and listen while he told me. And my direction was to listen for a minimum of 10 minutes. So the first day I'm doing this, he came home. I said, so how was your day? And he looked a little surprised that I was asking, but he told me something that had happened to him at work. I didn't know any of the people he was talking about because I had never had any interest in his work whatsoever before this moment. And so he told me I had checked my watch, and when the 10 minutes were up, I just sort of wandered out of the room. When I was driving to the meeting that night, I felt better. You know, I felt a lot better, and I didn't understand how that could be. We fought every night when I went to a meeting, because he didn't want me going, we fought that night, but I wasn't crying in the car. And I know today the reason I felt better is because I had taken my focus off of the problem and I was busy in the solution. And I always feel better when I get into the solution, no matter what the status of the problem might still be. You know, after a while, I didn't check my watch, you know, I just asked him after a while, it really became a conversation. You know, he'd come home and I'd be anxious to ask him, well, whatever happened with Fred's little sick baby? Is she better? You know, now I'm interested in these people that he works with and the things that are going on where he works. And it started to change. You know, I remember I'd been doing that about, I don't know how long, 3, 4, 5 months, maybe. I don't know. And I was on my knees one night, thanking God for my sobriety. And I started to get up and I realized I was real comfortable in that house with that husband. And it didn't happen that day. Like I said earlier, it already happened. I was so busy in the solution, I didn't even notice the problem had ended. You know, I remember getting back down on my knees and saying, God, I believe if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do that and stay sober and have a happy life. Thank you so much. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. My very first thought was, boy, I wish this would have happened when I hated him. I'm very glad it did not happen when I hated him. But always my first thought is about me, because I realized this is going to hurt. He's going to die. It was clear he was going to die. And this is going to hurt. He was sick for a year and a half and he did die. It was a hard year and a half, but it was absolutely the best year and a half of our marriage because you taught me how to do that. You know, when he passed away, I made some funeral arrangements and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the afternoon off from work to be there. They did not know him. But of course they knew me and they came to support me. And I realized that day that what my sponsor had promised me had 100% happened. I knew that I had 100% made my amends to him. And I was so grateful that I had stayed when all of my very best judgment suggested that I should leave. You know, I just didn't see the point of staying. And I'm so grateful that I was willing to listen to somebody else and to believe I believed enough in Alcoholics Anonymous by that time to know that my sponsor wasn't going to tell me anything that she believed would hurt me. And so I went on that, you know, I followed her direction based on that thought. And I'm so grateful that I did. And I remember thinking that day of the funeral that's like the payoff for doing the work, you know, knowing 100% I'd made my amends and 100% that I could not have to feel guilt and think, oh gosh, if only I had, you know, done this or that. I had none of those feelings. What a gift. But here's the thing. That's not even close to the payoff. God's vision for me and presumably for you too is so much greater than anything I ever can imagine at any given day. On this day, right now, after he passed away, I started dating a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of you knew him, Vince, and, we fell in love and got married, and we had almost 30 really great years together, which never would have happened. First of all, I could never have been the kind of wife that, you know, that I was to Vince, nor would I have been the kind of person that would have attracted a quality man like Vince. You know what I'm saying? I mean, God's vision, as I say, is so much bigger than I could imagine. I'm so grateful that I've been willing to do the work, you know, that I've been asked. It's never, anytime my sponsor has asked me to do something like that, it, you know, it's it's never like, oh boy, I get to do this. It's never. It's like, oh my God, do what? You know, I can't imagine. Why would I do that? I'm so grateful that I'm just willing to do it. I want to talk a little bit. Well, I'll tell this one first. I want to talk about money, financial amends, but I'll talk about this one first. When I was a couple of years sober, I was down at my mother's house and, she said, oh, that box of things over there. I've been cleaning out cupboards and I think that box of things over there belongs to you. And so I went over and I opened it up and on the top of the box was this big 8x10 picture of a wedding party that I was in. And I about had a heart attack when I saw it. When I was drinking, I was working for this company as a secretary. It was one of my first secretarial jobs. I was probably 18, maybe. I was young. And there was this big office. There were 30 secretaries in this giant room. God, it was a terrible place to work. But anyway, so 30 of us, you know, all in these desks in a row. And there was the desks backed up to each other. So, like, I'm sitting at my desk and there's a woman sitting at her desk and we're looking directly at each other. All the desks were like that. So the woman that was across from me, nobody liked her. I didn't like her. Nobody in the office liked her. She was really kind of a pain. But I was apparently nicer to her than most people, not because I'm a nicer person, believe me, but because she sat directly across from me and it was to my advantage to be nice to her and have her like me, you know. So she became engaged and she asked me to be a bridesmaid in her wedding. And I remember thinking, wow, that's kind of sad that she would ask me. We had never done anything outside of work together, had never spoken on the phone outside. You know, we worked together. That's all. But she asked me to be a bridesmaid and I said yes. And so, she had this big wedding. All her other bridesmaids were all her sisters. And, so we, the dresses and the everything, you know, the wedding, her aunt called me one day about a month before the wedding and said, I wonder if you could give me the names and addresses of all the other girls in the office. I want to throw a surprise shower for her and I don't have their information. And I said, sure. So I got the list and sent it off to her. And so the day of the shower comes, the night, evening of the shower comes, and I'm living in Long Beach. The shower is in Woodland Hills, which is a fair drive, and it was raining. And I thought, boy, I don't feel like going to a shower. I don't get driving out in the rain and going to this stupid shower. I don't even like this girl. And, you know, you could imagine. And so I thought, well, I'll just stop around at the corner bar on my way out and have a drink. That'll mellow me out a little bit, and I'll be in a much better frame of mind to go to this stupid thing. So I stopped at the bar and I never made it to the shower. I did call from the bar and say that I was having car trouble. But I didn't never, and I'm sure they could hear the tinkling of the ice and the glasses and the music and everything in the background now that, you know, but whatever. So I didn't make it. So that was on a Friday. So Monday I go to work and she came in, all the girls are at their desk. She came in and she stood in the middle of the room and she said, so that everybody could hear, I want to thank everybody. My aunt threw a surprise shower for me last night and not one of you showed up. I don't know what those other girls were feeling, but I wanted to kill myself. I can't even begin to tell you how bad I felt that I hadn't gone to that shower. So I'm at my mother's house. And I'm looking and the wedding happened. I was in the wedding, but now I'm looking at the picture of the wedding party and I just, my heart, like, oh my God, I clearly owe amends to this woman. I don't remember her maiden name. I don't remember her married name. The company that we worked at no longer exists. There is literally no way I can find this woman. No way whatsoever. There's no way I can make amends to her. And I talked to my sponsor about it and she said, well, my experience with these kind of difficult, you know, missing people, so to speak, is, you know, pray about it. Ask God to show you a way that you can maybe somehow make this right in some way, maybe some indirect thing you can do. And so I started praying about it. I got sober in the Pacific Group, which is a huge group of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are like hundreds of people and somebody's always getting married and always having a shower. And I thought, finally, and actually this thought did come, this is an actual thought I had, not one that somebody told me. I thought, you know what, maybe what I should be start doing is showing up for these showers, you know, with an appropriate gift and act like I'm having a good time. I hadn't been going to them because I don't much care for showers, probably because of this experience, but whatever. But maybe I need to start doing that. So I started doing that. And the first time I did it, the first one I went to, I thought, oh, this is I'm on the right track here. This feels right. I'm showing up. I'm, you know, participating in this girl's shower. I'm being a friend. And so I kept going to these showers and I kept thinking, yeah, this is good. One night, I've been doing that a couple of years. And one night, there was a shower for a girl and it happened to be raining and she looked quite a bit, the shower was quite a distance away. And, I thought, oh, I don't want to go to the shower. It's raining. I don't want to go out there. I want to drive. Why are we even having a shower for this girl? I've never seen her at anybody else's shower. I'm building a case here, see, for not going. And, but the whole time I'm doing that, I'm wrapping my gift, I'm getting dressed, finding my car keys, because I've been well trained in Alcoholics Anonymous. I suit up and show up regardless, you know. So I went to the shower. And typically at the showers that we had in our group, because it was such a large group, there would typically be like 60 to 100 women at these showers. At this particular shower, I think there were 6 or 8 of us. I was so glad that I was there. So glad that I was there. When I was driving home from that shower, I remember thinking, well, I think my amend is complete now. I think that's the one I was meant to do. I don't think I have to do this anymore. Yeah, you know what? I don't think that's right. I think that that's one of those things I have to maybe do forever. You know, I don't think we get to call the cutoff date like, whew, that's done. I think these sort of universal amends, as I think of them, go on forever. And so I keep showing up to showers with my little gift and smiling like I'm having a good time. And it feels right to me. I don't live near the Pacific Rim anymore, which is kind of a blessing because where I live now, there's hardly ever a shower, but I'm actually planning to move back to that area. So I guess I'll be back at it anyway. That's that amend. So, but I really want to talk about money. I think a lot of alcoholics are owe money. I certainly did. My very first job, one of my very first jobs when I was young was at JCPenney Company. And I worked in the credit and layaway department on the evening shift. I think the store closed at 10 o'clock. So I worked from like 5 to 10 or something in the evening. And it's the credit and layaway department. It's also the gift wrap department. So people almost always pay cash for their gift wrap. So while I was working there, a lot of that cash found its way into my pocket. It's not going to be missed because there's no, you know, you don't write a receipt or anything. You know, you just put that money you do write a receipt, but nobody really wants their receipt. So you get the picture. So a good amount of that money found its way into my pockets. I worked there for, I don't know, maybe a year, and then I moved on. So fast forward. Now I'm sober. Many years later, I'm sober. I'm sober about, maybe 10 years. I mean, sober at least 5. And I'm speaking at a meeting, on steps 8 and 9. And, there's question and answers at the conclusion of my talk. And somebody raised their hand and said, have you ever stolen like from a department store or something? Now, let me just say had never been on my amends list. I completely had blocked it. I mean, I just never thought about it again. Literally had never, it's not like I intentionally didn't put it down. I never had thought of it. So now I'm standing at this podium. This guy says, have you ever stolen from a department store? And I said, why, yes, I have. And I told him the story, you know, I took money, found its way into my pocket. And he said, how did you make that amends? And I said, I just wrote a check and paid it back. Well, the story's true, except for that last sentence. I had never made amends. I had never written a check. I had never thought about it until this guy asked this question. Now I'm standing in an AA podium and I've told a lie and I started to sweat. And then the guy sort of asked a follow-up question. So I elaborated a little bit on my lie. And now I'm like out of my mind crazy. So I get home and I'm thinking all the way home, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? I get home and I'm married to Vince by now. And I tell Vince, now Vince is my loving husband. I'm looking for some compassion here. So I tell Vince what's happened. And he said, Jesus Christ, Pat, what's wrong with you? That's not what I was looking for here. You know, now it's like 11 o'clock at night. There's absolutely nothing I can do about this tonight. You know, nothing. And so I go to bed. Of course, I don't sleep. I mean, I'm out of my mind thinking about it. So the next morning, when the store opens, I call the store where I worked and I say, may I speak to the store manager, please? And she said, may I ask who's calling? And I said, gave her my name. I said, but it won't mean anything to him. And she said, well, may I ask what it's regarding? Well, yes. 10 years ago or whatever it was, I work for your company and I stole some money and I'd like to make arrangements to pay it back. And she's like, one moment, please. Do they get these calls all the time? I mean, she was like, nothing, you know, like it was just a call. So now I get the manager and I tell him my little story again. I said, I'd like to make arrangements. Oh, I should say, before I made the call, I prayed about it because I don't know how much money it was. It was, you know, $5 here, $2 there over a course of a long period of time. I prayed about it and I came up with a number of several hundred dollars that I am pretty certain covered it and then some. You know, I felt pretty comfortable that the dollar amount that I came up with was good. So now I have this guy on the phone. And so I tell him all of this. And I said, I'd like to know how to pay that back. And so he thought about it a minute. And he said, make out a check to JCPenney Company, and but send it to my attention with a little note reminding me of this conversation so I'll know what it's about. I said, okay. And so I sat down. I wrote out the check. I wrote the little note, and I sent it off. And I remember thinking, that's done. Never have to think about that again. Well, it wasn't quite done. 6 months later, by the way, I kept thinking I might get a thank you note from him. I don't know why I thought that. I stole money from him, you know, 10 years before, and I want a thank you note because I finally, whatever, I didn't get one. Anyway, 6 months later, I get a phone call from the new secretary of that meeting where I have told the lie, and he wants to book me to speak. And so we go in our calendars, we pick a mutually good date, and he said, oh, let's see. Oh, you'll be talking on steps 8 and 9. I said, you know, I talked about those steps last time I was there. Wouldn't you rather hear me talk about something else? And how about a tradition? I know a lot of people don't like to talk about traditions. I'll do that. He said, oh, no, we like to talk about amends. So I had to go back to that meeting and stand at the podium. This is Johnny Harris's meeting. I was so humiliated. I stood at the podium and I said, 6 months ago when I was here, I told a terrible lie from this podium and I'd like to clear it up now. I was so embarrassed. That's, you know, when that amend was 100% done, you know, money. So Vince and I are married. This is actually in sobriety, but it's a good story about money. We had owned a company and it was a small company. I mean, we were the two of us. And we had a tax guy who we blamed this on the tax guy for a long time. It wasn't his fault. It wasn't his fault at all. It was our fault, but we blamed him for quite a long time. And, we owed money to the IRS and we didn't have it when the due date came around, we did not have the money. So we just kind of ignored it. And, for quite a little while, actually. And one day we came home from work and there was a card. I don't know if they still do this or not. There was a card, a business card stuck in the door from an IRS person, or I don't want to say agent, but like a count, I don't know, whatever they call them. And it said on it, so it's her card. And on the back of it, she had written, please call or stop by the office to discuss the money you owe. So we took off the next day from work and we went down to downtown LA and we went in the office and we said, we'd like to see Miss So-and-so. And they said, you have an appointment? Said, no, but she left this card in our door. And so we'll have a seat. So we waited a good little while and finally she came out, took us into a conference room and she said, why are you here? And we said, well, you left this card in our door and we wanted to come down here and try to make arrangements to pay this money. And she said, I've been doing this for 30 years and I've never once had anybody show up here after getting that card in the door. Never. So I will say this. We believe absolutely, Vince and I believed absolutely, the fact that we did that made her see us as real people who really wanted to make this right. You know, you hear horror stories about the IRS making payment arrangements that are so terrible you can't even have money left to buy a stick of gum. That did not happen to us. She made such a very reasonable, unbelievably reasonable payment schedule for us. And she just said, you know, be sure to always make the payment. Don't ever be late because that triggers other people, you know, and they'll be on you. And so, I mean, it took us years to pay it off, but we paid it off, you know, one payment at a time. And of course, you know, when you owe the IRS, if you ever have a refund coming, you don't actually see that money, you know, they keep it. And I remember the first year that happened, I was like, oh my God, that's my money. I've been counting. It's not my money. It's their money, you know? We got to where every year we sort of felt like, wow, that's great. We just knocked another $1,000 off our bill. You know, it's funny how your attitude can shift when you're in the solution. You know, I remember writing that the last check to the IRS. I don't know that there's anything that's ever felt quite as good as that. You know, that was a really, really, really great day. I owed my father. We had borrowed money from my father. So my parents were divorced when I was young, and my father, Vince and I were buying our first house, and we needed some money for the down payment. And so I called my dad and asked him if we could borrow several thousand dollars. And, you know, it's funny. I never really thought about this until this moment. It was kind of a cheesy thing to do because I knew he would feel some guilt. I knew that he felt guilt about he had left my mother for another woman, you know, that, and I knew he felt like he hadn't been a great dad. And so, you know, I sort of played on that. So long story short, he loaned us the money. He said, when he gave me the money, he said, he probably shouldn't have done this. I'm sure he regretted it. But he said, you know, I understand when you buy a new house, there's things that come up that you don't expect, unexpected expenses, you know, that you didn't anticipate. So don't stress about starting to make the payments right away to me. You know, get settled and, you know, get whatever else you need to do there. And then you can start making payments. Well, he never should have said that because a considerable amount of time went by and we are not making any payments. And every time I talked to my father, that money was in my head. The fact that I owed him that money was in my head. It was like in between us. It was in between us. He never once mentioned it, but I thought about it every time I talked to him. I finally talked to my sponsor about it. She said, well, why aren't you paying him? I said, well, it's several thousand dollars. So I figured I would pay him in $500 increments. And I just haven't had $500 together at any one time. And she said, how about sending him $25 a month? Well, that's not very much money on a bill that big. I mean, come on. And she said, it's more than you've been paying him. So why don't you just start there? So I did. I wrote a check for $25, wrote a little note apologizing for the delay, and I sent it to him. And I can tell you this, the moment I sent that first $25 check, my conversations with him were entirely different. I felt entirely, it took away. Again, I'm in the solution now, you know. I'm in the solution. And then once I started doing that, I actually started sending him bigger checks as time went by. I could afford to send him bigger ones than I did. And, you know, it changed everything. It changes every money gets so in between people. It's such an interesting thing. Vince and I used to do it actually still goes on in the Pacific Group. We started a financial amends class for sober people that, you know, people, it's not a budgeting class. It's a financial amends. We called it finance class, but it's about making amends. You know, mostly the people who came to us were not happy to be there. They were sent there by their sponsors, to address, you know, the terrible situations they were in with creditors. And it started kind of by accident. I sponsored a girl who was married to a guy in the group. They weren't married all that long, a couple of years, and they had a little baby, and they came to us one day and they said, we think we're in a little financial trouble. Would you mind taking a look at this and seeing if you could help us? And so we looked at it and, oh my God, they were in such trouble. They were both in real estate, but they hadn't actually sold anything. And so Vince said, well, how much money have you made in like the last 6 months? Well, you know, I've got this deal in the works here. And you know, how much money have you made in the last 6 months? And they'd made something like $600 or something in the last 6 months. It was ridiculous. And they were living literally on credit cards. They were paying their rent with credit cards. And it was all at this moment going to crash down. I mean, they'd been doing it long enough that now it's, you know, the cards are starting to get cut off and, you know, they're so we worked with them. We really worked with them because I sponsored her. We gave them a lot of attention. You know, we had to move to a cheaper apartment. They were living in like a 3,000 a month apartment or something. And this was a long time ago. And you know, they got out of the trouble that they were in. And so like anything, you know, that works, you know, they had a friend, they said, oh, you should go talk to Vince and Pat. You know, they helped us. And so then this other couple comes and pretty soon we've got 60 people in our living room on Sunday mornings, you know, who want to talk about their finances. And so it kind of became this big, this thing. Obviously two people can't deal with 60 people in their finances. So if you were in finance class and you were had been there a while and you were steadily on track, steadily doing what you're supposed to do, then we make you a teacher. And now you've got three or four people that you're working with. And so it was great. You know, we would get, everybody would come and everybody would go off in the corner with their finance teacher and they'd go over what they'd done that week. And then we'd come back together for a meeting, not an AA meeting, but a finance meeting. And Vince would say to various teachers, you know, who of your people should share? And they would say, oh, you know, Fred should share. And it might be a good thing. It might be a bad thing. Maybe Fred's being asked to share because he's just ran up his credit card this weekend, or maybe he's being asked to share because he just paid off what we call dead horses, which is all that debt that, you know, goes nowhere and is going nowhere, but keeps growing. And, it was amazing the things that happened. I know people that were in that finance class 40 years ago who still pay their bills on Sunday mornings because that's when finance class was when they were in it. And they established that habit of on Sunday mornings, I sit down with my bills and I pay my bills. I can tell you this from personal experience. I'm sober 45 years. I haven't been in debt for at least 30 years, longer, I think, but at least 30. To this very day, nothing feels quite as good to me as walking down to the mailbox here, seeing that there's a bill in there, walking back up to my apartment, writing out the check. Yes, I still write checks. I know I'm very old fashioned. People laugh at me. I don't care. Writing the check, putting the stamp on the envelope and walking back down and putting it in the mailbox. Nothing feels quite as good to me as that to this very day. I have excellent credit. I pay my bills. You know, I don't have debt. I own my car outright. I mean, I live well within my means. I have several friends who are, you know, my age who do not live well within their means. And I watch the struggles that they go through. And it's so scary. You know, when you get to be my age, you really got to be thinking about the future here. And I am so grateful that I was willing to do the hard things, to make those hard amends, to go down to the IRS, call JCPenney. Man, that's maybe the hardest phone call I ever made was to JCPenney, honest to God. I'm so grateful that I've been willing to do that because these things have changed my life. Because it's not just about the money. It changes how I feel about every relationship I have in my life. When I am right with my money, when I'm living within my means and totally self-supporting through my own contributions, the way I react to you is 100% different than when I wasn't living that way. I like there's a line in the 12 and 12 that talks about money. It says, I'm reading it because I'm notorious for misquoting things. It says, it is the beginning of the end of isolation from our fellows and from God. That is absolutely the truth for me. Absolutely the truth. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I'm kind of done. I could talk all night, but I'm tired, so I'm going to stop there. I don't know if you do questions or anything. If anybody wants to ask a question, I'd be happy to answer it. If you want to fill in the time here, I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.